We want to thank y'all for tuning in to Run Up the Numbers.
Every Monday at 8 a.m. And if you miss us in the morning, you can catch the replay in the afternoon at 2 p.m. and again at 8 p.m. You can also check out the show's archived over at thenumbers.fm. And for you early risers, every Monday morning at 6 a.m. on 107.1 X-Ray FM.
Make sure you following us on all the social media, because we out here. Mm-hmm. Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, House Party,
hey.
YouTube, Twitch, Black Planet. Did someone say OF? MySpace, Tinder, catch us ticking on the talk, and Google Plus.
In this episode, we'll be putting you up on Connecticut will reportedly become the first state in America to require that all high schools offer African American and Latino studies. America executes Brandon Bernard, who was 18 at the time of his crime.
Also, 110 is a newly formed nonprofit that wants to change the way America hires its workforce over the next 10 years. And Oregon expects coronavirus vaccine to arrive Monday. Four state panel says it's safe and effective.
But first, let's jump into the Red House on Mississippi Avenue. The house located on Mississippi Avenue has been owned by the Kinney family since the 1950s. The attempt to evict the Kinneys, a black indigenous family, set off protests from activists that have hit a tipping point in recent days. Protesters have shown up in support, occupying the home and area around it to the discomfort of the neighbors, two different law enforcement departments, and city officials. And their presence has led to violent clashes with the police, with the mayor commanding officers to use all lawful means to end the protests. What is happening on North Mississippi Avenue didn't just pop up overnight. It is the result of systemic problems and of a series of events that go back years. William and Pauline Kenny moved to Portland from Little Rock, Arkansas, to escape segregation and the horrors that plagued the South at the time. Little did they know they would be facing a different type of segregation out West. They were denied a loan for the house because of redlining, the practice of color-coding federal government maps of every community. African-American neighborhoods were colored red, a warning to lenders that it was too risky to insure mortgages in those areas. As a result, the Kennys bought the Red House outright with cash in 1955, according to the Red House website. William Kenny Jr., the couple's oldest son, said the house at one point served as a rental for black families. In 1983, he moved in with his wife, Julie, who was an indigenous Native American of the Upper Skagit Tribe of Washington, according to the website. The people raised their three children there. The Kennys' problem started in 2002 when they took out a loan against their home to pay for their 17-year-old son's legal fees. The Red House website says that after years of disputes with the mortgage lender, their home ended up being sold at auction as a non-judicial foreclosure in October of 2018. The tactics we're facing of sneaky and illegal foreclosure tactics, predatory banking and loans, elected officials who take campaign contributions from the real estate industry, coupled with the violence from law enforcement and no real due process, have been used across this historically black neighborhood to displace black and poor people, Julie Metcalf Kenny, the family matriarch, said in a statement. If black and indigenous lives matter in Portland, this must stop. The state of emergency halted the eviction for 6 months, according to a news release from the Red House website. But on September 9th, Multnomah County deputies served the court order to the family. The sheriff's office said Koya Crespin, with the Community Alliance of Tenants, told CNN affiliate KPTV the encampment at the Red House was not only for the Kennys, but also in part to protest gentrification. This is systemic oppression. This is gentrification in real time, Crespin said. William Nish, the lawyer for the Kenny family, told CNN that they have filed federal and local cases fighting the eviction. After losing one federal lawsuit in a district court of Oregon last year, the family appealed to the Ninth Circuit Court, which denied their petition, records show. Last month, Nish explained, the family appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court and are waiting to hear if the court will take up their case. So, I've been, like, because we live not too far. We, like,
okay,
4 or 5 minutes from the house.
Okay.
And I want to say back in September, when we first started seeing the protests, mm-hmm, saw some stuff on social media, saw people gathered outside. They were holding a couple of events to raise awareness. One of my homies, Bianca, as a matter of fact,
okay,
DJ No BS, she DJ'd one of the events there. Just, again, to bring awareness and support around what was going on.
Okay.
So it wasn't until, I want to say, maybe late last week, or early last week, I was heading to the station, and it's part of my route to get to the radio station.
Okay.
From here. And I made a left and came around the corner, and it was like, whoa, wait, what is happening? And at this point, I'm at, it might have been Albina and Mississippi. And there was a series at that stop sign. There were like three different barricades before you even got to where the house was.
Okay.
And I was like, yo, this has turned into something. And it was mad, you know, people dressed in all black.
Yeah.
And I said, okay. And then I started noticing that it was popping up on the news and seeing all the coverage. I'm hearing more pushback than I expected. News came out that they have another property and that there may have been some misrepresentation in the story, saying that, you know, them being evicted would result in them being homeless.
Yeah.
Regardless of the fact, this is gentrification playing out, period. So shady lending practices. For people to say they have another house, so people of color can't have more than one property. Like, let's stop it. We know what this is. You know what I'm saying? And what's really discouraging is to have this conversation with other members of our community that are pushing back on it. It's like, what? I'm not here for any of that.
Crazy. And I just had caught a little bar that as of today that it looks like the barricades got pulled down.
Ooh.
In that it looks like the family struck a tentative deal with city officials.
Really?
Yeah.
That's dope.
So we'll see what's happening.
I did also hear that the new property owner, the person that bought it in auction, is looking to sell it back.
Yeah, and they didn't say, and so that's the thing is to make it clear that there wasn't, this isn't saying that there was a deal or an agreement in place for the home to be sold back to the Kenny family. This was just between the city officials and the people as far as those barricades happening.
Man.
Uprooting.
Yeah. Yeah.
What's the proper term? Gentrification.
I believe that's what it's called. You can't say you are for the advancement and well-being of communities of color. You can't kick all of the rhetoric and kick out all the phrases and have all the nice little hashtags in your bio. And then watch this happen in real time and say, oh, well, this is different. No, it's not. This is gentrification, period. So,
you said it like it needed to be said.
Come on, man. Mm.
Well, next up, 110 is a newly formed nonprofit that wants to change the way America hires its workforce over the next 10 years. Mm-hmm. Black Americans are still feeling the instability brought on by the pandemic when it first hit at the top of the year. Economists are saying that as of November 2020, a sluggish labor force and rise of long-term unemployment have left more than 1 in 10 black workers jobless. This, in conjunction with the exasperation felt by many African Americans still struggling with the realities of racial injustice, has prompted a group of people to the forefront who want to be about change, not just talk about it. Several top CEOs representing dozens of organizations and companies believe they have a plan to successfully secure millions of jobs for black workers over the next 10 years. As of today, the resultant coalition called 110 announced that it's committed to hiring and promoting 1 million black workers into viable long-term positions with opportunities to grow and advance, further strengthen their economic futures and that of their families. This is a moment in time for Americans to move past our divisions, to come together and reach our full potential as a nation. Our country's workforce of the future will be an increasingly diverse one, said Frazier in an official press statement. Through the creation of 1 million jobs for black Americans over the next 10 years, 110 has the potential to address persistent intergenerational gaps in opportunity and wealth. The strategy starts with connecting employers with outlets that specifically support the development of diverse talent who haven't graduated with a four-year degree. The mission of this coalition is not just to link black workers with long-term employment, but to fundamentally transform the American labor force into one that is more inclusive and equitable. 110 will forge partnerships with leading nonprofits and other skill credentializing organizations to create a more balanced talent pipeline and promote practices that allow employees and employers to succeed. 110 links our companies with the critical work we know we need to do to improve racial equity in America, said Rometty in the press statement. This will not only help our individual companies, but by removing structural barriers that have disproportionately hindered black Americans from joining the middle class, it will also help lift all Americans. By bringing together a coalition of key leaders and asking them to make long-term commitments, we have the ability to change employment practices and help break down systematic barriers, opening the door to full participation in our economy.
Man.
Baza bam.
Listen, that's what it's about right there. Erase the barriers, allowing us to participate. You know what I'm saying?
Man, I'd be 60K less in debt.
Hello.
If that 4 years of doing what I already did, because honestly, I winged most of my four-year college degree.
Right. Right. Because you already had the skills. You just needed the paperwork.
The paperwork.
That's it.
There's not really been a moment yet as far as who I am. I've kept textbooks because mm-hmm. I enjoy reading and learning certain things. Mm-hmm. But these textbooks are not textbooks that are only available in college. They're regular authors that you can right. buy and purchase right. this book.
Some of them right? you probably could have written.
That part. And right. so I think about how many times I'm really falling back on something that was from class. No.
Right.
This has been experience. Like, I do understand the foundation, but I think that there's a part of onboarding, as they say, and mm-hmm. training
mm-hmm.
at companies. There's so many people, if you talk to with a four-year degree, and even people that have got their master's and jumped into a career or followed into a field, how much of what they learned out of a book applies 0%.
Right.
They have to relearn even the things that they were taught in the book because how it applies in this
in the real world today. Is, right.
Yes.
Right.
And so I just this to let me come with what I have yeah. and show you that I can do this without that 60K that it's going to cost me to take 4 years of classes
yeah.
to show you that doesn't even show anything.
Come on, man.
Outside come of on. Debt.
It's, I mean, we say it a lot how important it is that these conversations are being held. It's another thing to see the actions behind it. And the statement of, you know, erasing barriers to allow us to, erasing barriers that have prevented us from joining the middle class, like, that's a word right there. That's a whole word, especially as the middle class is being erased and we're watching that happen. Man. We're seeing that divide just get wider and wider. I'm very happy about this. Very grateful.
Same.
Yeah. Yeah. So, in some other good news, Connecticut will reportedly become the first state in America to require that all high schools offer African American and Latino studies. According to CNN, Governor Ned Lamont announced on Wednesday, December 9th, he signed Public Act 1912, which requires school to include an elective course of studies at the high school level that provides students with a better understanding of African American, Black, Puerto Rican, and Latino contributions to United States history, society, economy, and culture. Man. That's what I'm talking about. That said, students are not required to take the offered courses. There has been increased attention nationwide to assessing what history is taught in schools and what is left out. In a statement, Lamont said, "This is a step that is long overdue. Increasing the diversity of what we teach is critical to providing students with a better understanding of who we are as a society and where we're going," the governor said. Adding, "This course in our high schools will be an enormous benefit not only to our Black and Latino students, but to students of all backgrounds because everyone can benefit from these studies." Miguel Cardona, the education commissioner of the state, praised the move and says 27% of students in the state identify as Hispanic or Latino and 13% identify as Black or African American. Identities matter. Cardona said in a statement, according to CNN. This curriculum acknowledges that by connecting the story of people of color in the United States to the larger history of American history, the fact is that more inclusive, culturally relevant content in classrooms lead to a greater student engagement and better outcomes for all. Man, I cannot tell you the pushback that my high school gave against multiculturalism in education.
For real?
And this, I graduated high school in 94. Okay. I went to a private school, and it was a Christian private school. So hear me out. In 1994, okay. Christian private school, this same Christian private school, mm-hmm. it was, you could get expelled for interracial dating. And this is, I graduated in 94.
No, not dating.
Yeah.
Specifically.
Interracial. Yeah. If you got caught being in a relationship with someone outside of your race, you would get expelled. And they would they wouldn't put that on your transcript, but you're getting expelled. We've seen it. We saw it happen a couple of times. Yeah, that was the high school I went to. So our social studies class was led by the assistant pastor of the church. And when this first came up, learning about other cultures, the pushback was like, no, we're all American. The only history you need to know is American history. And I looked, he said it, right? And I look at the other, there was one of the black student that was in my grade in that classroom. Okay. And I looked over at Art and was like,
you heard it right and you heard it first.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
So, you know, in that moment, what that makes me think of is, for one, your other classmates, what they heard in that moment.
I know.
I really want to know how, did anyone else, did that hit? Because I'm sure there was at least one. I feel like there's always that one that's like,
Yeah.
But as a total of the people that it didn't hit as anything, like, oh, okay, that makes sense.
Yeah. It, no one else in the room, did I catch, you know, any glances with her? No one said anything to me after the class? Like, hey, how do you feel about that? Like, we were young, we were impressionable. Again, it was a church school. So a lot of these people that they went to school with, they went to church with, which I didn't at the time. But like, yeah, this was like, you trust these people. These are your, not only your faculty and staff, but these are also religious leaders. So you're placing an additional, you know, level of value on that information. And yeah, I love that this is at least an elective to start with, that there's an option, but there definitely needs to be a conversation about what is being taught in the primary history class and the way they're addressing that.
And what actual American history is. Let's talk about what American history is, not the people who decided to write about it and take away the parts that they don't want to have to talk about or have question in class.
Right.
Let's talk about the actual history. We're talking American history. All this stuff is inclusive. All of this is included into that.
Right.
Well, things that I would prefer to have excluded. Mm-hmm. Oregon expects coronavirus vaccine to arrive Monday.
Hey.
Today? Four-state panel says it's safe and effective. Oregon's first batch of vaccine is expected to arrive today. A spokesman for the Oregon Health Authority said, officials do not expect vaccinations to begin Monday, and it's unclear how many people will be treated when efforts do begin. With recommendations from the FDA, CDC, and now the Western State Scientific Safety Review Work Group, Oregonians can rest assured that some of the best doctors, scientists, and immunologists in the world have reviewed the data and affirmed that the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine is safe and effective, Brown said in a statement. State officials have said that they expect to receive 35,100 initial doses from Pfizer this week as part of a broader shipment plan. By month's end, Oregon's total vaccine allotment could be between 197,500 and 228,400 doses, according to statistics from the governor's office and the health authority. Those totals include a yet-to-be-approved vaccine from Moderna and second treatments earmarked for people who received the first of two doses. Officials have said that they expect December's allotment should be enough to vaccinate 100,000 residents. Healthcare workers and residents in long-term care facilities will be the first Oregonians to receive the vaccine, and that process is expected to take several months. A schedule for making the vaccine more widely available is still unclear, and it could take well into the fall to vaccinate 70% of adults. The threshold, officials say, would be necessary to effectively curtail the virus through herd immunity. Oregon joined the medical review panel in October to vet the work of federal regulators responsible for approving coronavirus vaccines. Given the exceptionally fast timeline for developing a vaccine and underlying political pressure exerted by the Trump administration, officials on the West Coast wanted to ensure safety before offering to inoculate residents. The panel approved the vaccine in a report dated Saturday. "We will work as quickly as possible to deliver vaccines to the public, starting with frontline healthcare workers and those who have been hardest hit by COVID-19. Brown said in her statement, "Please keep doing your part to keep your family and loved ones safe. Wear a mask. Stay home when you are sick and avoid gatherings. Together, we can do this. Hope is on the way."
So, how are you feeling about this vaccine there, sir?
For me, it's a... I'm a chill. Couple of reasons. So, you know, for all the vaxxers, more power to you.
Right.
I'm not a flu shot person. I've not done that up to this point.
Okay.
So me jumping into line to get a shot for this, the first dose, as we talked about before, I don't even update my iOS software on the first run through.
I feel you.
So you take in that, and then they're going for, I guess the population that is primarily affected by this are older population. But I feel like this is a test run, because dealing with your older population, if there are complications from this vaccine, that's an easy write-off.
Right. Yeah.
That's where my mind goes. You can easily say, oh, well, this happened because age is involved. Health is already involved.
Right.
Other underlying factors.
Yes. Yes.
So that's kind of where that throws me for a little bit. What I would prefer, as I've said, I think a time before, is go ahead. These officials that promised to do this in front of everyone to make them feel better about taking this vaccine, how about you guys take it and we follow you for the next year or so?
Right.
And we see what it's talking about based on that. Let's see what pops up through that timeline. Let's make that a reality show.
Do that thing you was talking about doing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's kind of where I'm. Where are you at with it, sir?
There is a level of comfort in having other agencies on the local level verify the safety. My brother, he's a physician as well, and someone that he went to school with had put out an Instagram post discussing why it's understandable to have apprehension, but trying to reassure the public in the safety. Saying that this is something that we haven't seen as far as the globalization behind trying to find this cure. So you've never had so many countries and so many scientists at the exact same time aggressively trying to work on a vaccine, which did play a factor in speeding up the timeline. So, I mean, I, like you, am very cautious. And there have been some cases of people having adverse effects to the vaccine already. Here's the thing, though. That's what happens in clinical trials. That's part of it. And it's just that we're all, you know, everyone's completely aware. They're fully watching the process right now. And it's just like, what's going on? If this wasn't, you know, a pandemic, I don't think anyone would even be paying attention to how long it took for this vaccine to be, you know, to come to market. But yeah, I'm leery. And we're not saying this to, you know, strike fear into anyone that's listening. Please understand that. You need to make the decisions that are best for you and your family. Definitely. We're just moving with a little bit of caution. We are not conspiracy theorists.
0%.
Ladies and gents, that's not where we are, okay? We are just African Americans that have an unhealthy relationship with the medical industry here in the United States.
Yeah.
That's it. That's all.
And what I can put out there, you know, that there were 30,000 participants spread across 100 different clinical research sites that launched July 27, 2020. Mm-hmm. And 37% of those trial volunteers are from racial and ethnic, traditionally minoritized demographics.
Okay.
You know, put that out there. But again, as I've said, let you guys test it out.
Yeah. Yeah. Ain't nothing wrong with that. Yeah. Nothing wrong with that at all.
That's it. That's all. That's all.
As our next story. Yeah. America executes Brandon Bernard, who was 18 at the time of his crime. Bernard's execution Thursday evening, the ninth by the federal government this year, was one of five planned in the remaining weeks of the Trump administration. Brandon Bernard, who was 18 when he took part in 1999 double murder in Texas, was killed by lethal injection at a federal prison Thursday, despite the 11th hour attempts for court intervention. The case drew renewed interest in recent weeks and sparked debate over whether the death penalty is a necessary punishment for someone who was barely a legal adult at the time of the crime. Bernard, who was 40 when he was executed, was the youngest person based on his age when the offense occurred, in nearly seven decades to be put to death by the federal government. The Supreme Court denied a request for an emergency stay Thursday night, and Bernard was pronounced dead at 9:27 p.m. Bernard's attorney called the execution a stain on America's criminal justice system. Brandon made one terrible mistake at age 18, said the lawyer, Robert C. Owen, but he did not kill anyone, and he never stopped feeling shame and profound remorse for his actions in the crime that took the lives of Todd and Stacy Bagley. And he spent the rest of his life sincerely trying to show, as he put it, that he was not that person. Bernard was the ninth person put to death by the federal government this year after the Justice Department resumed executions in July after a 17-year hiatus on the federal level. This year, fear over the spread of coronavirus in prisons has largely led states to put holds on executions. But the surging numbers of COVID-19 cases and deaths in recent months had not deterred the federal government from acting in the final weeks of Donald Trump's presidency. Kim Kardashian West, who has championed criminal justice causes, again asked her millions of followers on social media this week to appeal to Trump to commute Bernard's sentence. She tweeted Thursday, "Just spoke to Brandon for what will likely be the last time. Hardest call I ever had." She added that she was in tears. Death penalty experts say that the way the Trump administration is moving ahead with executions during a lame duck period has no parallel that in the past, the outgoing administration would defer such cases to the incoming one. President-elect Joe Biden campaigned in support of a moratorium on a death penalty, favoring instead life sentences without probation or parole.
I mean, there's a lot of things problematic, right? But we go to, for one, this 18-year-old child was not the killer,
right?
Murderer may have had a part in,
right?
And he's catching the death sentence, which death is an eye for an eye. Death sentence is supposed to be an eye for an eye.
Right.
Right? So, and that's the way that it's kind of set up, regardless of how harsh that sounds. Now, an act versus a pattern, right? There are people who continuously display certain behaviors.
Right.
Which would then make them a thing. You know, I've been in a car and had a fender bender, and I've gotten out and directed traffic right quick.
Right.
I am not a traffic director. I am not that.
A stoplight, no.
I have plants that I've taken from one pot to another. I am not a gardener.
Right.
This same thing applies to individual actions in some cases, where you have to take in everything that is going into this, right? An action. And if you've been sitting since 18, so that's another 22 years. Or, well, sorry, I'm going to make sure I'm saying this right. That happened at 18 and he was 40, right?
40.
I'm 40.
Yep.
Okay.
Nailed it.
And there's nothing that proves that this is a behavior trait. And I've looked a little bit into this. There's not, he didn't go into prison and be, he wasn't wilding.
He wasn't wilding, right.
None of that stuff. How? How? And for the people that sit on this pedestal and sit on this high horse, as they say, this tall pony, and feel that their things are justified. I was having a thought the other day for whatever random reason about how many people have done things in their life by law. You should be sitting in a prison somewhere.
Right.
And when I say people, I'm meaning people who are living a pretty affluent life right now.
Yep. Yep.
But look down on others who have done things because in these moments, this is survival versus, not even versus, that are no different in their moments of modes of survival or moments of just not knowing what is going on in life because they're
right.
Impressionable children.
Right. Right.
How many people have gotten away with from the basic to horrendous crimes?
Yeah.
Things that are crimes.
Yeah.
But because they didn't get caught, they don't feel that they are a criminal.
Right.
They don't feel that they are a degenerate. They don't feel any of these things about themselves.
Right.
But someone who happened to fall into a place where they didn't make the best decisions.
Right.
Got caught up.
And couldn't it's afford. Easy
to, could.
Because that's what we're talking about, right?
Yes. Yes. Yes.
Couldn't afford the right lawyer to kick the right game. Couldn't
Look,
afford the right lawyer that has the proper relationship with the judge or the DA to, you know, lighten that sentence and have things go in their favor. So it's, I'm glad that you use the word affluent because it jogged my memory about this case where a lawyer used the term affluenza.
I was thinking about the same, that case ran right. through my mind.
Right. That kid got drunk, got in a car accident, killed four people, and then went on the run with his mother to South America. Like, what?
And got told basically because he is used to not having to answer for things because of his privilege.
Right.
That they should be lenient because he doesn't understand.
Yeah.
The effects of his behaviors.
Imagine that.
What about being in situations that you are pretty much living off of a post-traumatic stress syndrome since single digits?
Yeah. Period.
Like let's put those. I'm sorry.
Nah, but that's real, man.
It's those bits and pieces that bother me when seeing stuff like this.
Mm-hmm.
As a man who has had to deal with what has come from my moments of not thinking clearly, being very young, not just young, but very young.
Right.
And the things I've had to deal with because of that, but also the moments that I've made decisions and didn't get caught, but had to sit and think like what would have happened had I got caught.
Right.
Right. And understanding there's a lot of people that live in that space, but I understand that having that being caught before and seeing the effect of that has humbled me in a certain type of way.
Yeah.
Right? Because there was no reading what these DAs and everything else had to say about me as a child.
Bruh.
Based on a conversation.
Yeah.
They didn't include in none of my paperwork that I was gifted and talented education. They didn't tell in my paperwork anywhere that I was a grade higher than I was supposed to be. They didn't talk about any of that. They did talk about the decisions that I made
in that moment.
in that moment. Yeah. And also, because of those decisions, what that must mean about me as a human being.
And what that should mean for the rest of your life.
Exacto mundo.
Yeah. Yeah.
I just, these type of situations, like, come on. You're not even the person. It's eye for an eye. And as trash as that statement is, eye for an eye. There was no eye taken by this man.
None.
And there's nothing that shows that this is who he was.
Right.
And for a man to have to beg and plead with you and telling you this is not who I am and he's done nothing but show that through the time.
Yeah.
For what?
For what?
For what? And that's no, and that's not to take away from the victims of this crime.
Of course. Yes. Of course.
At all. This is not. But if they have the people who took their lives,
then what are we doing here?
That.
Right.
Help me to understand.
Well, thank you for sharing that, for real, man. Like, thank you for sharing how this affected you personally. Because it's one thing for people to experience who we are and how we are as adults. And, you know, give a lot of credit to the men that we are today, not understanding some of the things we had to face as children and some of the things we faced, you know, on this journey and some of the tough decisions we made and some of the penalties we paid as a result of that.
But, you know, one thing I want to say before jumping out of here, because I go back to this conversation that I had. So Guerra, Arturo Guerra, he was one of the staff at one of these facilities that I happened to pass through in my younger years. Mm-hmm. Arturo was an older Mexican-American man. He had been in the military, very militaristic in his approach to things.
Okay.
And I remember having a side conversation because of this being a youth facility dealing with children from the ages of 12 up to 21. We had a conversation, and he told me, as a man that fought in Vietnam, the amount of kids I've seen come through here with the same shell-shocked eyes because of what they've been through in these streets, that I saw these men out here in these fields of Vietnam, that has always bounced around in my head. There's a look. There's a look that's, and that doesn't get, because they just see animal, predator. They see all these things, but not taken into account. And this was an adult that had been in this system for a while, had trained to been essentially trained to kill, had been in the killing fields.
Right.
And saying that he was able to see 13, 14, 15-year-olds come in this facility with the same looks, glazed over eyes, as these men that were out here and were exposed to all of this stuff from Vietnam. That should tell you something. But there's no credence given to that experience.
None.
All you are is a menace. And get up out of here. That's that.
Whew. Say that.
Well, make sure you all check in with us every Monday at 8 a.m., 2 p.m., 8 p.m. as we sit down and run up the numbers.
Man, run up the numbers.
Kentucky Attorney General Daniel Cameron needs to resign.
Hosted by Ken Jones and DJ Ambush.
Brett Hankison needs to be charged with Breonna Taylor's death.
Special thanks to our researchers and writers, Claudia Claudio, Sham Shawan, Hannah, Alicia, and Joseph Watson.
Miles Cosgrove needs to be charged with Breonna Taylor's death.
Music by C's.
Jonathan Mattingly needs to be charged with Breonna Taylor's death.
Boom.